MediTalk with Dr. Ross Walker.
Good afternoon, Ross. How are you?
I'm okay, mate. How are you going?
I'm all right, mate. Sorry we sort of rang you a bit early, but we lost a news bulletin somewhere along the way. We did.
That's all right.
Let me see. I've got a couple of questions for you as a result of the success of last week. I've got a few more for you. So are you ready to go?
I'm ready to go.
I was about to ask you about the Prime Minister. Sorry, wrong email.
No, okay, no, don't ask me about that. You don't want my opinion there, I can tell you.
Here we go. Love your show, Dr. Ross. Hoping you can ask Dr. Ross this question. As an active 67-year-old, can I halt or reverse osteoporosis? And if so, could you suggest how, please? That's from Julie.
Yes, it's a really good question. The answer to that is, in many ways, no. But you can certainly improve if you've got some bone loss. So basically, you go from being normal to osteopenia to osteoporosis. 25% of postmenopausal females and about 5% of men over the age of 65 have a degree of osteoporosis. And it's all genetic. And that's the problem, that all disease is genetic, but your genes loads the gun and then your environment pulls the trigger. So there are five things you can do before you start talking about medical therapy, pharmaceutical therapy, to help reduce or improve osteoporosis. Number one, two, three, four, and five really should be exercise. And that exercise shouldn't just be cardio. It should be two-thirds cardio, a third resistance training to keep the muscles and the bones strong. Secondly is don't take oral calcium. And this is something that a lot of my colleagues in medicine still suggest to people, they take oral calcium. And there was a big study where they took 100 different medical studies, put them together in a meta-analysis, asking two questions. Does osteoporosis, do oral calcium supplements prevent osteoporosis, and do they improve bone strength? And the answer to both is no, but what they do is potentially put calcium in your arteries. So there was a 30% increased risk for heart disease in people who take oral calcium. So don't do that. Number three is to avoid soft drinks. So standard soft drinks, whether they're the standard ones you buy with sugar in them or whether they're the artificially sweetened drinks, still have a thing called phosphoric acid that rips the calcium out of your bones. And so people who have one of these things a day, and Brett, you wouldn't believe it, there are still people who would drink a standard soft drink every day, have much higher rates of osteoporosis. So I believe soft drinks should be regulated and energy drinks should be banned, and obviously the Beverage Council doesn't agree with me.
No.
And number four, vitamin K2, 180 micrograms a day at least, can take the calcium out of your arteries and put it back in your bones. Number five is to keep your vitamin D levels around 100, as I think we spoke about that last week. Now, once you've done all those things, if you already have osteoporosis, I believe the best therapy is a 6-monthly injection with Prolia. If you go to the internet, look up about Prolia and what it can do to you, no one's going to use it because there's always the side effect profile. But the point is, the serious side effect rate of Prolia is about 1%. The problem with having osteoporosis and having a bone fracture, the mortality rates after you've had a bone fracture, you fractured your hip or fractured your lower spine because of osteoporosis, is so much higher than a potential side effect rate from Prolia. There are other things you can take for osteoporosis as well. There's probably about 6 or 7 different things on the market for osteoporosis, but I think the best results come from having Prolia every 6 months, a subcutaneous injection.
I've got a couple of questions as a result of your answers, okay? You said exercise. My question to you is, what if it hurts to exercise?
That's a great question. You've got to find the least traumatic exercise you can do. So, for example, I believe the best exercise for us old farts is sitting on an exercise bike because it takes the pressure off your knees and your hip.
Mm-hmm.
You can pedal to whatever level you want to. Now, I played soccer and squash till I was 52, destroyed my right knee, so I couldn't do formal sport anymore, so I started exercising an exercise bike. So over a 15-year period, I've actually broken 3 exercise bikes from overuse, which I do every day, half an hour on the bike, and I do weights and stretching every day. So I think most of us can do some degree of exercise somehow. Some people find walking painful, but walking's good for you. Swimming's very good for you if you enjoy swimming. I just prefer sitting on the exercise bike.
Okay. You said don't take oral calcium. My question to you is, how do you get your calcium intake then?
This thing called dairy products. Dairy products are very good for you. There's a study called the PURE study of 220,000 people followed for 9 years in 50 different countries, and it found that those who had 3 servings of high-fat dairy per day over a 9-year period and 100 grams on average of red meat per day had a 25% reduction in death and cardiovascular disease. So it improves your bones, and it also doesn't hurt your heart. So go ahead and do it.
Okay, there you go, Julie. That was a great answer from Dr. Ross. This is from Emily Ross.
Yep.
Can certain generic pain relief medications play a factor in high blood pressure? My daughter is in her mid-20s, and she went to the doctor, and she was getting daily headaches. It turns out her blood pressure was quite high for someone in her age bracket. Because of her headaches, she was taking Nurofen daily. Her blood tests came back pretty normal, and we didn't really get to the bottom of it. However, she made the change to paracetamol, and both her blood pressure and headaches have improved.
Yep. Yeah, the answer is absolutely. See, the non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs, the standard ones like Nurofen, Voltaren, those sort of drugs, can certainly suck fluid into the system, put up your blood pressure, damage the kidneys. There's a potential of that happening in anyone who overuses these non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs. Now, a big study was done where they compared a lot of the non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs, Celebrex or Celecoxib, Nurofen, Voltaren, and they found that easily Celecoxib or Celebrex is the safest of the three, doesn't tend to put up the blood pressure or damage the kidneys as much or injure the gut, because many people who take these on a long-term basis, they can get gastritis, they can bleed from their gut, whereas Celebrex tends to be a lot safer. But even then, I wouldn't suggest people take it every day. And if you can get away with the more gentler paracetamol, by all means use that. But again, that's not harmless either. If you took constantly more than 4 tablets of paracetamol, so they're 500 milligram tablets, if you took more than 4 of those a day, you can actually damage your liver. So you've got to be careful about the pharmaceuticals you use. But certainly, Emily's question is absolutely correct. Yes, it can put up your blood pressure and possibly give you headaches.
Penny says, I've been getting the occasional heart palpitation more regularly than I used to. Why could this be?
Oh, look, the typical reason that people get palpitations is they're under stress, or maybe they've changed their coffee habits, so they're getting a bit more caffeine than they normally do. I mean, I'm not suggesting Penny would do this, but the use of illegal drugs can do it. People think, oh, I have a joint every now and then, and that's harmless. No, it's not. That can markedly increase your risk for heart attack, for palpitations, for atrial fibrillation. And the other thing is that as we get older, the electrics in our heart wear out more. So if you do a 24-hour monitor on a 10-year-old, 20-year-old, 30-year-old, 40-year-old, each decade there'd be more abnormal electrical beats, sometimes deteriorating to a thing we call atrial fibrillation, which you and I have been speaking about for years, which is the commonest serious heart rhythm disturbance. And so if someone is getting more palpitations, they don't just say, oh, well, I'm getting more palpitations. You have them investigated to make sure it's not atrial fibrillation, because atrial fibrillation can be serious, can lead to stroke if it's not treated properly. If they're just benign, what we call ectopics, and the heart is structurally normal, what I do for my patients is I give them a good dose of omega-3, say 1,000 milligrams of krill a day, and also magnesium twice a day, and that tends to calm the heart down a bit.
Thank you, Dr. Ross.
Pleasure.
We appreciate you answering those questions. Okay, AI, artificial intelligence.
Yeah.
It may be on its way to a doctor's surgery near you, but it's not ready to see patients, apparently. I mean, look, what is ahead with artificial intelligence in reference to medical sides of things will be fascinating in years to come, but it's not just ready yet, is it, Ross?
Well, I don't think it's ready yet, and I don't think it will ever replace good doctors. Now, again, a lot of stuff that can be just put into an algorithm that AI computes and spits out an answer, I don't have a problem with that at all. But it still doesn't... can you imagine? You're just given a diagnosis by AI of a cancer. mm-hmm. and you're sitting there crying, what's the computer going to do?
True.
I mean, yeah. nothing. So the computer has absolutely no human empathy. There's no human touch involved. And a lot of my patients never get touched. And I'm not talking about sexual touching. I'm talking about they never get a cuddle. They never get someone put a comforting hand on their arm. And doctors, good doctors, do that for their patients. They give them the empathy. They give them the human touch, which you'll never get from a computer. But there are also new algorithms coming through with AI that will be able to analyze scans 24 hours a day, pick up stuff that maybe the human eye misses because doctors can make mistakes like the rest of us can all make mistakes. And the AI will stop those mistakes. And a lot of the times as well, you can get a constellation of symptoms. The AI can spit out a diagnosis in about 5 seconds that will then allow the doctor to make a more accurate diagnosis. But I really do not believe that a computer will ever replace a human being to give people that sort of service that I've just mentioned.
Do you see it being in the future a combination of the both? Like, for example, you might go to your GP and you'll tell your GP what the problem is, what you're suffering from, and in there will be a microphone and the GP, and your problems will go to the AI and the GP will talk to you, but AI will, I suppose, spit out the bottom a report based on what you told it, and the doctor absolutely. Will look at that and talk to you about that.
Absolutely, and I think that's a really great innovation because there are times when there are rare conditions that often people go from one doctor to the next, to the next, to the next, and these are fine print stuff in the medical literature that the AI knows about because the AI is just an algorithm that scans everything that's on the internet and can come out with some rare diagnosis. Now, again, the AI may not be always correct, and that's where the experience of a doctor is important. So I have a cup on my desk that says, please do not confuse your Google search with my medical degree. And I think that's – I do. And I think it's a very important point. Please do not confuse the AI algorithms with somebody who's had 40 years of medical experience, because there are things that a computer will never be able to do for you. But exactly what you said is exactly where I see the power and the importance of AI in the future.
A genetic modification has been discovered that protects mice against cancer and allows them to live up to 20% longer. Now, the discovery is especially promising as the benefits can be transferred to ordinary mice by a single transplant of blood stem cells. This is only in mice, we should stress.
Yeah, it's only in mice. And there's a particular protein called KLF1, which is supposed to be the master switch in immune cells that controls the activity of many different genes that affect our immunity. So these researchers basically altered this activity of this particular gene, and they found that then when they did that, the stem cells involved, when they were infused into a mice, prolonged the life of a mouse by about 20%. So what we're saying here is, if this is not prime time stuff ready for human consumption or whatever, but we're moving towards the new era of medicine, which is the treatment of aging. So David Sinclair, who is an Australian, actually grew up around the corner from where I'm sitting, is now the anti-aging guru at Harvard University. And he says that aging is a disease that is preventable and treatable. And this is where we're getting to the point. All of our modern diseases, whether we talk about osteoporosis, as we did at the start of the segment, or whether we talk about heart disease, cancer, Alzheimer's, whatever, all these diseases are diseases as a consequence of aging. Even though they're genetic, it's the aging that starts them off. So the biggest risk factor for cancer is not cigarette smoking, it's getting older. And so the older you are, the more prone you are to all of these different diseases. So if you treat aging, you stop people getting there. So that's where we're moving towards. It's something that I'm becoming very, very interested in. I take a bucket of anti-aging stuff myself, and it'd be really interesting to see how stem cell therapy progresses over the next 10 to 15 years.
You said you take a bucket of anti-aging pills. Can you see evidence that it's working for you?
Well, I can. And a lot of people are saying to me, you know, I saw you 5 years ago, you actually look younger. And I feel younger and I feel more vibrant. And I met a friend of mine who's a rather controversial cardiologist by the name of Dr. Asim Malhotra from the UK, who's out on a speaking tour around Australia talking about his concerns about the RNA vaccines for COVID. And I had breakfast with him the other day, and he looked at me and said, mate, I saw you 5 years ago. He said, you look 10 years younger. So it was a nice comment. But, yeah. You know, whether it's just me being a bit self-absorbed, I don't know. But I'm just saying I do feel a bit younger. I do feel better.
Okay. Researchers in Sweden have found further evidence for how this particular virus, the Epstein-Barr virus,
yep.
can trigger multiple sclerosis or drive disease progression. Bloody okay, viruses, so, Ross.
Ah, viruses. They're the cause of a lot of issues. Now, mate... Epstein-Barr, what condition does that cause? What common condition does Epstein-Barr virus cause?
It's the herpes virus, isn't it?
It is a herpes virus, but no. What it does is it causes glandular fever.
Of course it does, the kissing disease.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so most of us have had glandular fever at some stage in our life.
Mm-hmm.
90% of the world's population have positive antibodies to Epstein-Barr virus, so adults I'm talking about here. What they did was take 700 patients with MS, 700 controls, age-matched controls, and they found those who had MS had much higher level antibodies against Epstein-Barr. So they're suggesting that Epstein-Barr is not caused by... multiple sclerosis is not caused by Epstein-Barr, but if you have... a high level of a reaction to it, that might change something in your immune system that starts the autoimmune process that causes multiple sclerosis. So why this is important is, there's all of this talk about vaccines here and vaccines there, but if we could develop a vaccine against Epstein-Barr, it might stop people from getting multiple sclerosis.
Fantastic.
That's where we're thinking about.
Yeah,
so,
okay.
So that, and there's a lot of work going on. I have a liaison with a woman in Germany who's a researcher over there who is actually developing very high-powered treatments against Epstein-Barr because she believes that long COVID is due to a reactivation of all these dormant viruses like EBV, like the other herpes viruses, like shingles, like all of this stuff. So it's really, really interesting stuff what's happening in the infective space, so to speak.
When I was reading that, I'm right in saying that virus can lay dormant in your body for years and years and years and years and never have any effect on you. Is that fair to say?
Oh, look, it's not just Epstein-Barr. It's all the herpes simplex viruses, the herpes zoster virus that causes shingles. The simplex viruses cause cold sores and genital herpes. There's another thing that we don't hear about or talk about a lot, a thing called CMV or cytomegalovirus. And that is, most of us have that living in our body somewhere in a dormant state. But as we get older and our immunity gets more dodgy, the CMV comes out and can cause a whole lot of issues as well. So we've only really spoken about a lot about viruses since COVID's happened, but viruses do a lot more than people realise.
It's estimated that up to 80% of women in menopause experience hot flashes. Now there's a new drug. This is in America. Is this drug going to be available in Australia shortly?
Yeah, hopefully it will. It's called Veozah. And see, the thing is about the treatment of hot flushes these days, it's typically hormone replacement therapy. And a lot of women get disabled by these horrible hot flushes. They're dreadful things that can really make you feel horrible. You can't sleep at night because you're flushing so much. This is a trial of about 1,000 women, average age just over there, around 50, which is when, of course, menopause happens. And they found that there was a significant reduction in hot flushes using this stuff over a 12-week period. But, like all drugs, there's the potential for side effects, and this appears to have some modest effect on the liver. So, but still, it works, and for the women listening who've had, whose life has been really affected by hot flushes, anything would be a welcome release. Because there's still, and I think a bit incorrectly, a bit of a cloud over hormone replacement therapy. And the problem for HRT is a third of women do really well on it, a third of women doesn't hurt, doesn't help. Another third actually causes them side effects. So you don't want to stop the people who are actually getting the benefits. You just have to pick who's going to get the problems with it and try to avoid using it for them.
And last but not least, Is loneliness really as damaging to your health as smoking 15 cigarettes a day?
Well,
surely
it appears
not.
So. No, it appears so. This is 148 studies in a meta-analysis of 300,000 patients, 7.5-year follow-up. And it showed that that people who are lonely have 50% more likely to die prematurely as opposed to those who feel socially connected. Now, I'm not talking about people who live by themselves,
right,
because many people who live by themselves choose to do so, prefer their own company, and we're not talking about, we're talking about people who feel genuinely lonely, who don't feel that human connection and want it.
Right.
And it shows that the problem with loneliness, it has a pervasive effect on all aspects of disease. So if you feel lonely, more cardiovascular disease, more cancer, more Alzheimer's, because you're losing the social connection. It's so important to have that connection with people. And an 80-year study from Harvard University showed the one key to health and happiness is to have someone else in your life who loves and cares for you, who you love and care for. So it's really important. I think as a society, there's just so many people on the planet. We need to keep that connection with our fellow man. I think that's so important.
Absolutely. We sure do. All right, mate. Our time is up. Thank you as always. We love talking to you, and we'll do it again next Tuesday.
And
okay?
I love talking to my mate, Brent. So
all right, Ross.
Good on you, mate.
Thanks, mate. We'll talk to you next week. See you, mate.
Bye-bye.